This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I am here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
With Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
And once again with Chris Murphy.
Hi. People are going to get sick of me, I fear.
You got to ride this as long as it'll take you.
I'll take it.
This week, we're continuing our Pride Flashback series with a look at BPM, the 2017 French film about ACT UP Paris. And Richard and Chris will be joined by some fellow Broadway dorks for a Tony's preview, because that's an award show that's coming up right now, unlike the Emmys, which are so far in the future. But first, before we get into any of that, there's been some news over at the Academy. There is going to be a new CEO of the Academy. And David, I'm going to throw to you pretty much right away, since when I saw this as a rumor, you had information about what this all means, and I would like you to share it with me and everyone else.
It means that those inside the Academy are pretty happy from sources I've spoken with. Bill Kramer was the CEO of the Academy Museum and was really the figurehead behind getting that off the ground. So he's developed a lot of relationships, and he's very proven in the specific areas that I think those within the organization we're hoping to see from the successor to Don Hudson as the CEO. I think the Academy is in a particularly perilous moment right now after last year's Oscars. The not only handling of what happened with Will Smith, but the communication bungles were so frequent and severe that I think all involved look at Kramer as a really smart, fresh start who knows a lot of talent, knows a lot of people, was very instrumental in one of the Academy's bigger PR boons of late. And
The museum.
Yeah, being the museum. And I think they're satisfied. This is what they were hoping to happen.
When you say fresh start, I mean, given that he's kind of already inside the house, like he's obviously a new person, but it seems like he's like a steady hand who has a little bit of a new direction, but nothing too crazy.
Exactly. I think in terms of fresh start, you're looking at somebody who is within that, you know, Academy umbrella, somebody that is seen as, you know, very competent and very personable. There were definitely some mixed feelings from what I gathered about Don's tenure generally. And so I think everyone's just looking forward to a new chapter after everything that happened last year.
Yeah, I think, you know, Don held that position for 11 years and through so much change, you know, some of it, most of it, obviously beyond her control. But I think she became such a polarizing figure just because she had to deal with Oscar So White and diversifying the voter body and then Envelope Gate and now the Will Smith slap. And there's been something almost every year. And you know, even when the Academy Museum was taking forever to be built and costing so much money, I feel like a lot of the blame went to her. And then Kramer was actually brought in to sort of, not to replace her, but to replace the person who had been in charge of making that Academy Museum happen. And he kind of helped get it back on track. So I agree from everything I'm hearing, too. It just feels like it's time for some fresh blood, really, because, you know, Don had to be in charge of it for so long and through so much turmoil.
And to Rebecca's point, I mean, a good chunk of that was obviously out of Don's control.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about where the Oscars were 11 years ago, you're not going to even necessarily point to mishaps that happened on their stage, but just the dramatic changes in the way we watch and talk about movies. And the Oscars have certainly struggled to respond to a lot of that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, say, Bill Kramer would have handled it better. But, you know, having gone over those bumps, I think there's some hope that there is opportunity for a less bumpy next few years.
I was interested reading the Enkler report about Bill Kramer, kind of when it was still rumored that he would be in there. And it pointed out that when the Academy Museum opened, there were a good number of people who thought that it omitted the Jewish history of Hollywood. I think probably as part of their efforts. You know, I went there a couple months ago and they really go out of their way to highlight like filmmakers of color and actors of color and places where Hollywood has failed those people. But it said that we've heard that Kramer has worked hard to meet with and listen to critics and is busy evolving the museum to take these criticisms into account. And part of being CEO of the Academy, I think, is knowing that you're never going to make everybody happy because there's just always going to be someone complaining. But someone who's already had that experience of trying to smooth over ruffled feathers while keeping an eye on diversifying in the future, that seems like a really good balance.
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/littlegoldmen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/littlegoldmen.
So we're going to go on to our Pride flashback for this week. And Chris, this was your pick to talk about BPM, a 2017 film that I have put here sort of as a fake chronological order deal, because last week we talked about Rebel Without a Cause from the 50s. And this movie is set in the early 90s, which makes it the next earliest setting of the films we'll discuss. But this is a much more recent film. And I think you watch it for 10 minutes and you realize it can only be made now. But Chris, why did this feel like of all the potential movies we could have discussed, why was this the one you picked?
That's a great question, Katie. And I did start off by apologizing to our team for having to watch a 2.5 hour French movie that is about the AIDS crisis. It's not the easiest to watch, but it is really, I think, a beautiful, beautiful film. And it sort of, as you said, although it was made in 2017, it captures a sort of a queer narrative and sort of a standard queer narrative that we've seen since sort of the 80s and 90s that used to sort of be like the only queer narrative that used to appear on screen in terms of, you know, capturing, you know, how devastating and frankly horrific and terrible the AIDS crisis was. I mean, we've seen it in a lot of different films and plays and musicals, Angels in America, The Normal Heart by Larry Kramer, The Inheritance, most recently. I mean, Rent is like sort of the big seminal one, I would say, at least for me as a musical theater head. And even Philadelphia, the Tom Hanks's Oscar-winning film. So I just thought that like for Pride and for as a great way to sort of kick off and sort of like look back while we move forward, I think BPM is sort of a perfect film because it is, you know, it was made only 5 years ago in 2017, but it really is classic and a really, I think, an excellent entry in the genre of sort of a depressing and sad but very vital and very necessary to watch queer narrative of how devastating the AIDS crisis was and is still.
Richard, I want to throw to you because you put BPM at the top of your top 10 list in 2017. And I'm imagining that you still stand by that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's an AIDS movie that, you know, there are other things like it, but I think that what Robin Campillo does so beautifully is train that gaze in one direction toward the Larry Kramer, the political action of the normal heart. And then, you know, we have this one, I mean, staggering scene of death. But before that, and even kind of in that, he allows for so much life, you know. And I think that oftentimes in movies from the 80s or 90s about people living with AIDS, the sick person kind of gets a little cordoned off into that sadness and that, you know, and it's people concerned about them and, you know, they're a little bit removed from life. And in this, though, I mean, you know, there's sex. There's a really, really moving hand job scene in a hospital. Like,
yeah, really moving.
I think that the way that Robin Campillo just uses all parts of the human experience to locate us in this very fraught time in Paris is just so beautiful and ingenious. Like, it's a really fresh approach, I think, to this material. And yeah, it's still very resonant 5 years later. And the rumor is that jury president at Cannes, Pedro Almodovar, really wanted to give it the Palme d'Or, but some of the other people in the jury didn't feel quite so hot on it. And so they gave it to the consensus pick, The Square.
I totally agree in terms of like the sort of the joy and the queer joy and sort of the sexiness of this film. And it's one of those things where I feel like a lot of people recently have complained that, like, we need to get away from, you know, the sort of overwrought and overplayed sort of AIDS play narrative, and we really need more films with queer joy and fun. I mean, we just talked about Fire Island. I think that's a great example of, like, all these, you know, the possibility of all these other queer narratives that we can tell. But as Richard said, I do think that this film really, like, it holds space for both. And especially in Pride Month, and I know this is a Pride series, and we're in Pride Month right now, a lot of this movie takes place at Pride or is, like, sort of centered around Pride. And as we, like, sort of, you know, we make all these jokes, which are very true about, like, corporate Chase Bank Pride, it's very easy to forget, like, why the whole thing exists at all, in a way, you know, because we're, you know, we've sort of gotten past this moment. So I think BPM is a really, it's a wonderful film to sort of remind us, oh, this is why, you know, the marches and this month is important, and why, yeah, we need to actually, you know, take time to celebrate and also to protest and also to fight for our rights.
It's funny that even in this movie in the early 90s, they're like, oh, Pride, it's all going to be so stupid. Like, even then.
They knew.
It's also interesting to that point. I remember watching this movie near the end of 2017, and that was a pretty big year for queer film. We had Call Me By Your Name. We had Beach Rats. We had God's Own Country.
A Fantastic Woman, too.
A Fantastic Woman, yeah. All movies that I really like, the most part, those are downers. especially, like, I remember coming out of Beach Rats and just, like, kind of being catatonic for a few hours. It hit me pretty hard. And this one, it has just so much space for life. I mean, it's a messier movie than some of those. It's not quite as compact or, well, you mentioned the 2.5 hours, Chris, or tonally consistent, but I think that's why I love it so much. It kind of pulsates to the title of the film with a real feel for being inside that kind of movement, fighting for your life and fighting for your community's lives. And there's a real energy to that I didn't forget about, but revisiting it now, it's like, oh yes, I remember the exact context in which I first watched this movie, and it kind of went down the same way again, which was cathartic almost.
I remember the energy of the dance scenes, which kind of recur throughout the movie and I think mean something different every time, but I had forgotten how electric the conversation scenes. They're all in this, like, college lecture hall yelling at each other in French, but I can, like, feel the energy of the conversation and the disagreements and people snapping when they agree with something or don't. And you've got Sean, this main character, who's, like, kind of in some ways the most confrontational of some people in the group. And you just hang on every word that they say. Again, even though it's in French, a language I do not speak, I was amazed by the flow of that dialogue and so many of those really long scenes, how much they grab you.
Yeah, I think you can really, it's the way he captures that sense of urgency that is just, it's so powerful. And I'm not an easy cry, but I have cried every time I've seen this movie, in Cannes during award season that year and 3 days ago during that last scene. It's just the way he builds it all to that is just so powerful. And you know, a lot of those like meeting scenes, or even when they're meeting with doctors and pharmaceutical companies, could come off so dry. But just the way they film it and the actors, it just all feels so powerful. And it's just a really phenomenal storytelling.
It is. And so that leads me, I wasn't at Vanity Fair in 2017. I wasn't an Oscar expert back then, as all of you might have been. Why didn't it get nominated? Like, it just blows my mind, because it was so wonderful. I remember watching it in 2017, and like that sort of like stirred, you know, it really, I was very upset. And I still, to this day, I don't really understand how it sort of just did not get a Best Foreign Language Film nomination.
Well, I think the sex is one reason why, and I think the politics is the other. I mean, the complaint that I heard at Cannes a lot from people who were, you know, perhaps predisposed to liking the film was that, there's so many of these talking scenes and they're going over and over and the politics of it. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. Like, it's supposed to show that, like, the surreality of what was happening, these young men dropping dead left and right all around you, that had to be met with all of this bureaucratic discussion. The contrast there is so, it's wild, you know, but that was the reality of it. And I think that, like, Campillo is admirable for leaning into the sex of it, yes, but also for forcing the audience to really sit with, like, the process of trying to get this thing recognized and treated, you know. I think that something about that energy, that maybe a little bit brash, kind of aggressive, like, no, you're going to sit and listen to us talk this through, maybe alienated too many viewers.
Yeah, and this was before the now international branch instituted a kind of save system, where it had become frequently controversial the kinds of films that would be passed over. This is a very finicky group of voters, as we've learned, and their selection process is unique compared to other branches and other categories. So it's also just a case of, you know, you take all those points that Richard made, and then even if it's widely acclaimed, relatively widely seen movie, as it was in that year, and even as France is one of the best performers in this category consistently, it was always the case that a movie that could rankle like that would miss the cut. And that did happen that year. I think it was actually cited as one of the examples of why they did institute a change to the system.
Well, where does this fall in the Academy's international membership drive? Like, I'm looking at the page for it, and this is the last year. And Fantastic Woman actually won that year, which is interesting. But it's the last year that the international feature winner wasn't nominated in another category. Like, since it's been Roma, Parasite, Another Round, Drive My Car. So it feels like the Academy wasn't yet where it is now in terms of paying attention to international film in general.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the answer. It's developed so rapidly the last few years. But I think that was just before you really saw that.
Yeah. And it didn't even make the short list that year. I remember it got cut, you know, when that list of however many comes out where it's the short list to be considered for the nominee. So it was cut from the process pretty early.
Yeah. It feels like that had to be a catalyst to sort of which is the amazing thing that the Academy is doing, which is becoming more international. And, you know, the fact that this was so close to Parasite and Roma and yet completely ignored, it feels like, yeah, that this snub had to have sort of been a catalyst for change, which, I mean, it's sort of a parallel to the movie in terms of, you know, not getting your due, you know, but sort of paving the way for future generations. So, which is kind of bittersweet.
I was also looking back at the How to Survive a Plague, the documentary about ACT UP in America, which lost the Best Documentary Feature Oscar to Searching for Sugar Man in 2012. Kind of a classic, like, they go for the crowd pleaser. Searching for Sugar Man is not a bad movie, but How to Survive a Plague is so bracing in really kind of similar ways to BPM from what I remember of it. And it didn't win. It's kind of a familiar story. Richard, you talked about Philadelphia last week a little bit in terms of, you know, a movie with Tom Hanks, a straight actor playing this, you know, really landmark gay character and something you wouldn't take away. And you have talked about Philadelphia, I think, on Blank Check a few years ago. And that, I think, still kind of stands up as like the Oscar AIDS movie. Like, Dallas Buyers Club has come since then. I mean, do you watch BPM and think, like, my God, why can't we ever like pull it together and recognize something that feels this real?
Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia, you know, very much a product of its time and all of its, you know, slight failings. I think that movie kind of has a bad rap. I think it actually is a kind of striking film that really spoke to that era, you know, and to think of it as a kind of an act of atonement in some cases on Jonathan Demme's part, because the lore is that he made that movie because he was so horrified by the reaction to Silence of the Lambs from the LGBTQ plus community at the time. But, you know, again, product of its time. I think that where BPM sits in relation to Philadelphia is, I don't know if people have watched Philadelphia, you know, recently and have memory of this, but there's this scene where this very straightforward film suddenly kind of veers into the abstract when Tom Hanks's character is listening to this opera and he's talking to Denzel Washington about what the opera means to him. And it's the camera is kind of doing interesting things and there's these flashes of color kind of. It's a really, that sequence is kind of the entirety of BPM in a way, you know, because I think that I think it's important that at the time these narratives were told to, you know, presumably straight audiences all around the country who maybe didn't have firsthand knowledge of this or experience with this, that it was told kind of just the facts, like, but also, you know, a clear emotional arc. Whereas BPM feels like, not that it excludes anyone, but it feels much more sort of in community, you know? And I think that I think both things can and should exist, but I think they're distinct in that way. You know, and I think that The Inheritance, the play that Chris mentioned, this big two-part thing that was in London and much hailed and then came to New York and didn't fare quite so well. I think that was trying to do something similar, a sort of in-community discussion about the loss of a huge swath of a generation of gay men. But I think it didn't quite get there. I think that in the late 2010s, AIDS wars, I think that BPM still comes out on top.
Yeah, and it should be said, BPM won the César, so it wasn't like it, you know, unheralded after.
Yeah, it was like a big box office hit in France, which is great.
Huge.
And also, it should be mentioned, that this is based on Campillo's own experience. The character who dies in the film is based on Sean, is based on someone very real to Rama Campillo. And I think that also really helps that sense of kind of visceral intimacy, much in the same way that certain characters in Angels in America were based on people that Tony Kushner knew.
It recalls The Normal Heart, too, a little bit, particularly that looking at it from the inside.
Yeah, and I was going to just offer Rent for Jonathan Larson and said all, you know, all these classic narratives. Yeah, I will say I have never seen Philadelphia, Richard, so the way you just described it does actually make me want to touch down and give it a shot because I, you know.
It's definitely worth it, I would say. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mentioned the character Sean. I just wanted to shout out the actor Nahuel Perez Biscayart, who plays him, who is so incredible. And
incredible.
He had been rumored to be like close to winning Best Actor at Cannes. That didn't happen. But just a really, really great performance that feels like kind of the driving engine of the film. I mean, Arnaud Valois is also really good as Nathan, but I think he really, Biscayart really sells the film. And I told him as much at the Queer Palm Party at Cannes, and it didn't go very well. I'll just say that. He was very nice, but it was there was a language barrier and also just me kind of stammering over my words. But I think it's also fun to note that Adèle Haenel is in this film.
Yes.
And she, you know, obviously was from Portrait of a Lady on Fire. The previous year at Cannes in 2016, she'd been in a Dardenne Brothers film. And Haenel recently did an interview where she said she's quit the film industry because she's a very big leftist and she's like, it does not align with my politics. This industry is corrupt, blah, 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 blah. So I'm going to go do theater, which I think, you know, I watched the interview with, you know, English subtitles and she's a real force of intellect and conviction and a fascinating figure in the French film industry. And I think that's so interestingly reflected in this film, in her character.
I was about to be so upset when you said she quit film, but if she's doing theater, that's okay. I'll fly to France. I'll go see her on stage. And didn't she protest the César Awards recently?
She walked out when Roman Polanski was presented with an award.
There we go.
I believe,
okay.
And that's a big deal in France to do that. You know, like they still love their Polanski. So
Well, I think he won Best Director that year.
She's an admirable figure in that industry. I hope that somehow she can be lured back, at least maybe into super independent film, because she's such a good performer and
phenomenal.
Yeah.
Well, you can watch BPM on Pluto TV, which is how I watched it, but there will be ads in it, fair warning. And you can also rent it on wherever else you rent movies. And truly, it is 2.5 hours with subtitles, really well spent, and like maybe a cathartic cry at the end. I mean, it's still sad, but I think it's really something that you shouldn't miss. So go catch up with it. Mm-hmm.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So now we're going to turn to the discussion that Chris and I had with our fellow theater goers. Katie, you said dorks. I think geeks is a lot kinder.
No, I'm theater so sorry. Geeks, I'm not up to date on the language.
I would take nerds. Dork and dweeb. Those are the mean ones. So we had Jackson McHenry from Vulture and Esther Zuckerman from Thrillist, people who Chris and I have definitely seen out at the theater throughout this whole 2021-2022 season. So it was a lively, perhaps long conversation.
But worth every second.
Yeah, about who could win on Sunday night and maybe who should win also.
Yeah, and some of the categories, I think we really didn't land on exactly anyone. So, you know, time will tell who takes it home.
Well, it's June, early June, so in addition to the start of Pride Month, although it always seems related, I mean, these things are all causally connected, it's also Tony season. The Tony Awards are on Sunday night. The return to the regular June date after last year's weird thing, and it was in the fall, I think it was. So it actually hasn't been that long since we've had a Tony Awards, but these are awards, and we do cover awards on this podcast, even if we don't talk a lot about theater. So I thought I would convene an expert panel to go through the potential big winners or potential big losers, so you can win your Tonys pool if you are still doing that in 2022. So I'm joined by VF staff writer Chris Murphy.
Hi.
Vulture senior writer Jackson McHenry.
Hello, hello.
And Thrillist senior writer Esther Zuckerman.
Hello.
I'm so happy to have you all here. I have run into all of you at various times in the theater as we have tried to see as much as we can. Jackson, my guess is you have probably won the tally in terms of having seen the most, largely because it's a big part of your beat at Vulture. So I want to ask you first. I'm also working off of a handy, you did a predictions thing for Vulture of what's going to win. What do you think the sort of narrative of the season was, if there was one, and beyond, like, we're back from COVID? Was there anything that unified this season past that kind of landmark moment?
It feels like it's been a three-part season almost because of the COVID delay, in that there were shows that opened last summer and fall that were sort of the first out of the gates. I guess officially it was Bruce Springsteen's little sort of encampment at the St. James doing his show. And then Passover, which is this play about police violence that did not get any nominations, which is frustrating, I think. But then a sort of whole batch of what felt like more experimental plays that were opening in the fall, that were sort of before producers wanted to bring out the big blockbusters that they had planned for the spring, kind of testing the waters, testing the ticket sales. And then those were opening alongside the sort of major juggernauts like Wicked and Lion King and everything. And then a batch of shows that were in performances that are technically still part of this season, but were in performances in last, you know, March and then reopened. Things like Six and The Girl from the North Country that now feel like they've been open for 3 years and are mysteriously in competition against everything else. And then finally, the arrivals from this spring, the shows that would have been sort of traditionally Tony competitors that all seem to squeeze into April. I think there were something like 15 openings over the course of April. I saw our theater critic, Helen Shaw, at all of these performances. She just looked increasingly wearied. I was like, can we like get you, you know, lumbar support through insurance or something? But those were things like Macbeth with Daniel Craig, Sarah Jessica Parker and Matthew Broderick and Plaza Suite, but also sort of new arrivals like A Strange Loop, which had been off Broadway way before the pandemic, and even Funny Girl. And so it's sort of like weird to think of all of these separate categories and separate contexts in which all these shows were developed and suddenly be like, okay, you have to choose the best of these very different productions, and they all have different goals. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think you've articulated that well. It did feel kind of scattered between revisiting stuff that I had seen right before the shutdown and or stuff I was anticipating seeing, and then just brand new things. And I think somewhere in there, I did have that feeling of, you know, Broadway's back, baby. Esther, was there a show or a moment in a show that you most potently felt that throughout this season, like that Broadway really was truly back?
Oh, wow. I mean, weirdly, the thing that I was going to say was I went with Jackson to the reopening of The Lion King.
Oh, where, sure. Yeah, that counts.
Where Julie Taymor came out and gave a speech about how Broadway is back, and I started crying, which doesn't involve this year's Tony season at all. But it does feel like, I was going to say, it does feel this strange loop, maybe, but of this Tony season involves the fact that I saw Six in March 2020, the weekend before the shutdown, and then that Monday, somebody who, an usher in the theater, had tested positive, and I wasn't sure whether I should have even gone. And then I saw it again, like, and I was like, oh, okay, we're back, I guess, but I'm repeating the same thing. So that's sort of the strange way I felt sort of ushered back into this Tony season.
Yeah, Chris, you know, you, in addition to being a great writer for us, you're also a performer. You have a history of performing. And I'm curious, like, you know, a lot of people in the theater community. Has that sentiment, at least in terms of Broadway, permeated to the performers? I know it's been a very fraught experience, but like, because people keep getting sick and having to be out and then coming back, and it's a lot. So from the industry side of things, how do you think this season has been for them?
I think that's a really interesting question. I do think that's quite true that it has sort of permeated into like the performances, kind of similar to Esther. Somehow in the midst of Tony season, I saw Wicked twice in a week, which also is not up for any 2022 Tony Awards. But one of the performances I saw, Glinda, the first Black Glinda, she was out, and I saw her come back for the second show. The energy in the room is palpable. You can feel sort of the energy of the performers on stage, and their connection is sort of unlike anything that I sort of felt before the massive shutdown. I mean, Richard, we saw Come From Away. I think that was like the first performance back for that cast, and it felt like a literal rock concert, like Bruce Springsteen level sort of just energy and vibe and just electricity. So, and that's sort of on the good side of things, right? So it's like really the energy is so palpable in the room. But then on sort of the upsetting side, I don't know if people saw this, but Beanie Feldstein, who's Fanny Bryce, she just tested positive for COVID, I think, in the last 24 hours. So now, you know, she has to miss a swath of shows because of that. So as much as we might feel that, you know, we're sort of, Broadway has been back since like the September 2021 Tonys. COVID, it's still very much a player in the game, and it does really affect these runs of the shows. And you can see it, you could feel it with the performers.
Broadway also feels like a weird canary in the coal mine with COVID in a way, because I think people are very susceptible, you know, with the dressing rooms are small, the backstage are small. And so like, through the Omicron waves, plural, you know, we've seen shows having to take breaks. We've seen major stars like the Sarah Jessica Parker and Matthew Broderick both getting COVID at the same time. You know, it's felt like, as Chris was saying, it's felt sort of stop and start. And you sort of get, when shows start having to cancel performances, you get that like feeling in your throat, like, oh no, it's happening again.
Yeah, and it's meant that a lot of these shows have had to fall back on their understudies and swings, and especially the big shows like The Lion King and Wicked have managed to stay open because they have just banks of emergency Elphabas they can call out of retirement in Michigan, which is literally what they did for one of them, to do a performance.
Amazing.
And the newer shows have had to shut down, which has been very hard for them financially because they just don't have as many people who know the parts. But there's also been a push for some acknowledgement at the Tony Awards of the understudies and swings and ensemble members this season. And I believe Kate Schindel, the equity president, was tweeting about how, like, despite rumors that it won't happen, yes, something will happen. Who knows? Given it's CBS, probably not very much. But it does feel like there should be some sort of category. You put in the emergency Elphabas, you put in the emergency Nalas, Julie Banco, Beanie Feldstein's understudy. Jennifer Simard, who is Patti LuPone, one of the understudies for Joanne and Company, is already nominated. So, you know, let them do an all understudy number.
it seems at this point, especially after this season, that it's sort of crazy that there isn't either a best ensemble Tony or like a best swing or a best understudy or some like legitimate acknowledgement. I mean, obviously, I hope they have a number, they have a moment, but like an actual award. I mean, the swing tracks in these shows, you know, you have to know at least, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 to 8 different tracks for these shows. It's really incredible. And, you know, they never really necessarily get their due. So I hope that that's at least, you know, that conversation extends beyond Sunday night. If, you know, we need to acknowledge them in some way, I feel.
And I think they shouldn't be taken for granted, considering a friend of mine was in an off-Broadway show. And I after the show, I said, oh, that was great. You want to meet for a drink? And he said, oh, I'm really not allowed to be indoors for the run of this because we don't have understudies, like pretty much. So it's amazing that those resources are there. And I agree they should be celebrated. Also talking about going back to Wicked, going back to Lion King, like, I feel like they should have some sort of Tony category for like still trucking along, like, you know, or like an 18th replacement of Elphaba. I mean, Emergency Elphaba is a great name for a memoir if anyone wants to take that. But
the old gal still got it. Yeah. Award, you know.
Well, let's get into specific who's going to win, maybe who got snubbed if people have opinions on that. And I figure because it's usually the big ticket driver in any given Broadway season, although maybe not so this year. Let's start with musical. So in the best musical category, you have Girl from the North Country, which Jackson mentioned, MJ about Michael Jackson, Mr. Saturday Night, which is a stage version of the Billy Crystal film from a long time ago, Paradise Square, which I actually embarrassingly don't know much about, Six, the musical, and A Strange Loop. Now, Jackson, you have predicted A Strange Loop winning. I'm going to guess that Esther and Chris, you are in consensus with that decision.
Yeah, I'm going to go all in on that. All in on that one.
I will say I'm a little, like, I'm worried because I'm very actively rooting for A Strange Loop. I have a slight worry about Six. I don't think it's really going to happen. I still would, I guess, place money. But Six has been just such an enormous crowd pleaser over the however many odd sort of disjointed years it's been running and has the sort of, like, little girl showing up dressed like Queen's sort of vibe to it, but I'd say A Strange Loop generally.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, Esther, I do feel like what you said in terms of how it came out literally like the day right before COVID sort of hit, sort of works against it in a way that it feels like it's been around for three times as long as basically every other nominee. So as much as Six is a crowd pleaser, it's fun. The score is amazing. They're making it into a movie. They're filming it professionally. I think they just announced that. So it's having a moment. I do think it's hard to ignore Michael R. Jackson's incredible, groundbreaking, never before seen Pulitzer Prize winning original musical, A Strange Loop. So,
yeah, in like a just world, COVID would have not happened, and one of the many small improvements from that would be that Six would have already won a Tony for the 2019-2020 yeah. season for best musical. But I do think, like Esther said, the case for Six is that a lot of Tony voters are producers, and especially road producers who have a vested interest in trying to get a best musical that is a moneymaker. Because then it makes it easier to advertise your, you know, San Francisco engagement of the show. But I think there's also such a vested interest in the sort of artistic qualities of The Strange Loop, its specificity, its of the moment. It's already won a Pulitzer. It's opened just right before the Tony voting season. So I'm hoping for a band's visit like win there.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting, Strange Loop is so fascinating. I saw it off Broadway, and in that intimate space with probably the barrier to entry financially, the audience felt younger than a Broadway audience does. It felt more diverse than a Broadway audience does. When I went to go see it on Broadway, and this is a show that deals with Black queer sexuality and the theater and all of this stuff, and it's very pointed in a Broadway context at the audience it's performed to, in a way, which you might think could be kind of alienating. I mean, when I went, there were two Black women sitting behind me. And at one point, one of them turned to her friend and said, do white people get this? And, you know, the Tony voters, it's not the most diverse body of awards voters. But I think in some way, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, anyone here, but like, I feel like that alienation or that intended alienation actually works in this show's favor because it is very viscerally, I think, proving one of its points in that way.
I will say I saw it with a friend, and then I sent my white older parents to go see it with saying it's amazing, and they came out and loved it. So, you know, to that sort of Tony voter demographic, thumbs up.
I would say on that note, like the sort of barn burning of it, and that it's like sort of takes on the Broadway establishment directly and still it comes out successful. That sort of exists in, you know, it takes on not only Broadway, but Tyler Perry, you know, white, gay, you know, patriarchal culture, all of these different systems are sort of equally sort of raised to the ground, if you will, in an artistic and sort of undeniable way that it does. It doesn't feel like it just takes on Broadway. It's like everyone gets an equal like punch and gets to sort of look inward and, you know, inward at themselves. So I do think that sort of also works in its favor.
In that predictive view, Jackson, how far do you see A Strange Loop going in terms of other wins? I mean, you have great performances. I think there are 3 nominations in both featured and lead, and obviously Michael R. Jackson himself. Do you see like a Strange Loop sweep on its way?
I think it certainly could be possible, especially in the terms of the book feels very likely as for a win for it, especially if it's going up against Six wasn't nominated for its book, and I can't imagine trying to reward the sort of weird self-justifications of the Michael Jackson musicals book. It is wild. Lynn Nottage already has 2 Pulitzers, and then she wrote this, and it's questionable. But its score, I think, might actually be something that I can imagine breaking in Six's favor, just because Six is so dependent on all of these pastiche pop songs that sound like great pop songs. And then Strange Loop, as we said, takes on everything, even has some very pointed Scott Rudin jokes. And in the performance categories, it's going up against a show that was engineered by Scott Rudin, the massive money-making super show that is The Music Man. And as wonderful and incredible as Jacquel Spivey is in A Strange Loop, I think it is very hard to go up against Hugh Jackman for leading actor in a musical. He is, you know, the entire raison d'etre for The Music Man. The audiences love him. He can get the Broadway Cares auction to sell. There's one clip of him getting auction members to pay $20,000 for a whistle with his saliva on it at the end of the show.
That's a steal.
It's wild. And the weird thing is I think he's objectively miscast as Harold Hill. It's not a great performance. It's sort of against his vocal range. And Sutton Foster, his co-star, is similarly miscast. And
she
in some ways, she has better charisma.
But she makes it work better than he makes it work.
This is my long-winded way of saying that I do sort of imagine that Hugh Jackman will be getting the award, even though that hurts my heart.
In that way, the show would prove a little critic-proof because there was much ballyhoo about The Music Man for years. And yet it kind of, I mean, obviously it sold a lot of tickets, but when I went, it was a Wednesday matinee, so maybe that was partly to blame, but like, I could kind of feel the audience trying to convince themselves they were having a great time, or maybe I was just projecting, but I guess it doesn't really matter because Sutton Foster and Hugh Jackman, with all of the financial might behind them and that show, might just prove undeniable, I suppose.
I mean, it's kind of funny in the comparison to like what A Strange Loop is about, is that The Music Man like is the establishment. You can't have like a more sort of establishment musical with then you have these glitzy like Broadway stars. And as much as Hugh Jackman is a movie star, he's paid his dues. He has a Tony, he hosted the Tony Awards. Like he is sort of, you know, probably arguably Broadway's biggest male lead star, you know, crossover star that we have. So I also, like Jackson, I also am worried that, you know, he and his wide vibrato might sing all the way to the Tonys. But that being said too, I also recently saw Mr. Saturday Night, which I sort of specifically went because I wanted to see Shoshana Bean, who was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, and she did call out, so that was tough for me. But I was actually sort of like impressed or wondering. I'm not a huge Billy Crystal guy. You know, I mean, I love When Harry Met Sally. He's wonderful. Mike Wazowski, fantastic. But there seemed to be just like a lot of love for him in the room. It's just like, it's basically just him doing whatever he wants in a musical, doing like, his, you know, his shtick for a while. And like, he's also, you know, a la Hugh Jackman, one of our few crossover theater or Hollywood artist. So I don't know if there's like a sentimental wave for that, even though Mr. Saturday Night sort of came in under for me. It wasn't not my favorite show of the season. I sort of was sold I thought it was going to be like lots of like showgirls and dancing, and it's just sort of like a small 7-person, you know, older cast, you know, singing, doing their songs. So I don't know if anybody thinks that could also happen.
Well, and I actually wanted to ask any of you, I didn't see MJ, but I have also heard, sort of buzz for Miles Frost as a potential candidate for the role. So I wanted to sort of ask anyone if you think that could possibly happen.
Well, I think the helpful thing with MJ is that there's no controversy with that show. You know, it's an easy one to vote for. I don't know. I mean, I think that's definitely true, Esther. The MJ definitely has its diehard fans. Whether those people are diehard theater fans or are diehard MJ fans or both, I don't know. But I think that with Crystal and Jackman, there's always the potential that they split the sentiment vote. And that someone like Jacquel Spivey or Miles Frost could kind of sneak in there. If you were going to break that tie, I would probably give it to Spivey just because maybe that would get swept up with the broader Strange Loop momentum.
I haven't seen MJ either, but I have heard from a bunch of people that it is actually surprisingly like very fun, very dancey musical, and that Miles Frost does really wonderful work. But I've heard more Jacquel is like sort of like, you know, star, like standout, and Miles is a part of a really great ensemble. That's a really talented ensemble of actors and performers in MJ. So I guess I would also defer to Richard. I think that would happen.
I have seen MJ, and I did not have a great time, but it is just because I was sort of haunted the entire time by just thinking about the allegations against him. But it is a spectacular dance whole sequence. Christopher Wheeldon, who directed it and did the choreography, it does feel like there's sort of an outside chance, and maybe not even an outside chance, a good chance of it winning for choreography, which is in itself interesting because you're like, how much is it choreography for the show? How much is it just perfectly replicating Michael Jackson's Dangerous Tour? How does that work? How does authorship work in choreography? But yes, and Miles Frost is giving a very, very perfect, exact impersonation of Michael Jackson. That I think, you know, there could be a branch of Tony voters that are like, love the show, great spectacle, why not?
You might have been the person who actually told me that. You told me that it's like a good dance. Okay, that's all coming back to me.
They
now.
Put out the first number from MJ on Twitter at one point, and I remember one of my friends being like, the number of retweets this is getting, the amount of heat this is getting, you never know.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, Jackson, you're predicting Sutton Foster to win in the lead actress category. I would maybe say, just for my own somewhat limited viewing, that Sharon D. Clarke from Carolina Change could be the spoiler there, just because that's a very respected show that got a revival that felt like it was done because it was timely, but also because Carolina Change in its original run maybe didn't quite get the attention it deserved because it came out the same year as Wicked, right? And Avenue Q. And there's a documentary about that Tony season, and Taboo, I believe, is the other one in that running.
That's the outlier of the of those.
Yeah. So there was a sense of, like, you know, justice for Carolina Change in 2021-22 season. But it was long enough ago, it was in the fall, that I don't know if it still has that momentum.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that it could win musical revival, but I also doubt it with The Music Man, sort of, as everything that we've mentioned about The Music Man sort of so far, even though it was not a very good production and Carolina Change was a very good production.
Well, Music Man evokes everyone's mediocre high school production, so it yeah. gets that nostalgia
and
factor.
Of course, then there's Company, too, the gender-swapped Company.
And Company has been literally just putting Stephen Sondheim's face on playbills for the month of May, which is a little, you know, bald-faced, just, you know, look, you love Sondheim. Yeah. He is gone. Time to reward it. The sort of like, what was the Imitation Games campaign? Honor the man, honor the movie.
Exactly.
Honor the man, honor the very British, not very New York-y feeling gender-swapped musical.
Well, it's interesting that the Company, Carolina Change, Music Man sort of three-way fight. That Company, actually, their lead actress, Katrina Lenk, who won the Tony for The Band's Visit, actually did not get nominated. Some would say that's a snub. Others would say that makes sense. So it seems like momentum-wise, Carolina Change might actually have a little bit more in that way, because Patti LuPone probably just going to walk away with it, right? It's Patti LuPone finally playing Joanne in Company on Broadway. She's been doing this for 10 years, and you know, in one way or another, between the Kennedy Center and the Sondheim Red Dress 80th birthday celebration. So that seems sort of almost like the biggest locky lock that there is, whether or not you think she really worked in this production, or if you think this production really worked, there, you know, I have some feelings about it. It's not my favorite production of Company. I'm a big Raul Esparza, John Doyle, 2007, or I think 6 or whatnot. That was more for me. But that's a long way of saying I am hopeful Sharon D. Clarke, you know, could emerge victorious. And maybe that would mean that there might be some, you know, some slight little chance, the Carolina change, with a gorgeous Jeanine Tesori score written by Tony Kushner. Just a really phenomenal, weird, operatic musical about a black woman who's a maid for a Jewish family in Louisiana in the 60s that really never got its due. There might be a way. Or Tamika Lawrence, who's amazing as Dot. She's in the Best Supporting Actress category, and she was in Black No More, which was off Broadway, and had a really banner year. And she just killed it, miscast, singing. She was singing Lost in the Wilderness, and she forgot the words at the end, and she actually made up lyrics that were better than what Stephen Schwartz wrote. And I'll say it.
Well, with that, let's move over to the play category, which is, in recent years, feels like the more star-studded, although there are, as we have mentioned, big stars in the musicals. So the best play nominees are Lynn Nottage's Clydes, Martin McDonagh's Hangmen, The Lehman Shirley from Stefano Mastini and Ben Power, The Minutes, which is Tracy Letts, and Skeleton Crew by Dominique Morisseau. Jackson, you have predicted the Lehman Trilogy. That was probably the best thing I saw on Broadway this season, so I am going to agree with that, both in predictive sense and also that's what I would like to see win, I think, at this point. But Jackson, would that be your pick too? Not just a prediction, but also your favorite?
It's sort of a lot of the plays that I most loved are not nominated in the category. I like the Lehman Trilogy a lot. I really admired it. I had a lot of sort of smaller quibbles that added up to just pangs of dissatisfaction in it. It has an odd way of sort of papering over, because it's about the history of the Lehman Brothers empire. And the three actors play all sorts of characters throughout. And it sort of elides the history of slavery in the beginnings of their sort of cotton trading in a way that sort of they've added, I think they've changed it from the British production and added a little bit of an acknowledgement, but it sort of carries on, and the big tragedy is more about their ambition. In a way that you're like, these are incredibly precise performances. This is incredibly well done, beautiful spinning set. I feel like the spinning set is going to win because people just love it when sets spin. but there's just a little bit of like not quite as hooked in as I would have liked. And there are plays left off, like for instance Dana H. and Is This a Room, which played in Rep at the same theater, alternating performances last fall, which were both small downtown productions. Is This a Room is the reality winner. Arrest transcript performed as a script, and with the moments where there were things censored, just sort of bleeps and it goes dark and it's left off. And Dana H. is this incredibly compelling, haunting lip sync, basically reenactment from Deirdre O'Connell, a downtown theater legend, who is also in the Amazon series Outer Range. I discovered watching it this week, and she like came in, and my roommate was like, "This actress is fun." And I was like, "Oh my god, that's legend, Deirdre O'Connell." she lip syncs this playwright Lucas Nias' mother's interviews about being abducted in Florida and taken around by a man who is a white nationalist. And so I personally would choose Dana H. as the best play, but it's not nominated.
Deirdre O'Connell is nominated, though, and yes. I really, really hope she wins. I don't think she will, but I would love that win. That would be an amazing win.
I predicted her as just like, I can't choose anyone else, even though, yeah. and sort of like, and Mary Louise Parker, who I think also maybe is going to win, but
I think
knows.
Mary Louise Parker will win, but.
If Deirdre wins, she wins a $10,000 tip and decides which other queen goes home, right?
I also am pulling for Deirdre, but didn't Mary Louise Parker, she just won the last in the September Tonys, right?
The question is whether anyone remembers that Mary Louise Parker won last September. Like, I had forgotten, and I was like, right, that would be 2 years of Best Actress in a row, which Mary Louise Parker deserves it. Mary Louise Parker is incredible. How I Learned to Drive is incredible. She did How I Learned to Drive.
Truly.
More than 20 years ago with David Morrison is back, and that's haunting.
I was so excited about How I Learned to Drive because it was a play that I read in college. It was in our theater textbook, and in there were, you know, little black and white photos of Parker, and Morse in the original production. And it was one of those things where you just say, well, gee, it would have been cool to see that. Maybe I'll try to find it in some sort of video archive. And then they actually just did it again. And I, while I found Parker to be, you know, as she was in The Sound Inside, which she won for last year, so incredible, I was really blown away by David Morse, who I'd never seen on stage. And that is such a tricky part where he's playing this loving but also abusive uncle to the lead character played by Parker. It's a kind of memory play. I was just really blown away by him. And I see, Jackson, you've predicted that he'll win. And I mean, if that show wins something, it would be pretty cool if it was him.
Yeah. And I think that is just an incredibly tricky, haunting, unnerving performance. And it's so much about him having to seem both pathetic and absolutely horrible in it at the same time.
Yeah. And that degree of difficulty is often
for both of them,
something that voters, you know, they take a shine to that because it they're not only thinking about the work, you know, as a whole, but it's like, gee, to do that on a Tuesday night, like, you know, and then twice the next day, it just, yeah, it seems like a lot.
And I think there's a good amount of sort of theater goodwill built up for David Morse. He was in the Denzel Iceman Cometh that also spawned Austin Butler into finally getting Elvis.
Spawned is a good word.
Reformed him from the Carrie Diaries to Denzel. He's an incredible actor telling Baz Luhrmann, whatever. But David Morse was, I think, the best performance in that Iceman Cometh by far. And it's sort of maybe a little bit of like a Laurie Metcalf back in like 2015, where it was like, she's been in so much good theater. And then finally everyone's like, right. But anyway, yeah.
It also helps too for his category that the three Lehman Trilogy actors, they all got nominated. It's a pretty big, I think there were seven nominees. So, I mean, if we're talking about vote splitting, I don't know how you pick between the three Lehman Trilogy brothers. And then sorry to American Buffalo, we're sort of not really in a mammoth space, I think, as a community right now. So already that sort of, I think, creates a little bit of a pathway for David Morse to take it. And yes, as everyone said, him and Mary Louise Parker were both really phenomenal in it.
One of the most scrutinized categories on the play side of things, and for reasons that I think are very frustrating, is featured actor in a play, because Jesse Williams, who Jackson, you've predicted to win for Take Me Out, that performance became very famous online because although they take your phone and put it in a sealed kind of Mylar bag or neoprene bag, and so there's not supposed to be any footage of the nudity in the show, something did leak out, and all of a sudden this Broadway play that Richard Greenberg wrote, you know, 20 something years ago was like trending on Twitter. Do you think, any of you think that helps or harms Jesse Williams' chances? I would assume kind of help in a kind of cynical way.
I that was part of the reason why I predicted him, just partially because he has handled it in an incredibly, like in a way that he shouldn't have to deal with. They're so explicit in the theater. It's a show about a man coming out on a baseball team and all of the tension that inflicts, and has scenes where they're nude in locking rooms taking showers, where the point is the awkwardness of the nudity and the way in which people start to observe each other and think about, you know, sexual attraction, think about being looked at, which disrupts the presumably straight atmosphere or whatever. And he has really handled it with a commitment to saying, you know, theater should be a space that we respect, and we are trying to do this because we're performers and we're trying to tell a story. And I think it's sort of him and Jesse Williams, and then, what's his name? The third actor who's
Michael
nominated.
Oberholzer, who's really great.
Who's really great, and he plays a sort of raging homophobe character. And all three of them are really good, and it's a great ensemble. And I was sad that Brandon Durden, who is wonderful as sort of the counterpoint to Jesse's character, who's this big star, who is also great in Skeleton Crew. There should just be a Brandon Durden Award for being great in multiple shows. I think that Jesse Williams, he's also a TV star, and there's sort of some skepticism of like, oh, you're coming into Broadway from Grey's Anatomy, you're not really a true theater person, and he's kind of proven his commitment to the theater in a way.
Yeah, there was literally a Variety headline that I kept seeing that was like, Jesse Williams is a theater guy now. It was very much explicit. It felt like very much an explicit, like, okay, this guy is going to win the Tony. This is like his anointment that he can like make the transition from one to another.
I would say, yeah, I think it only, like, it could only sort of push the needle if the performance is actually good, and he does really wonderful work. Jesse Williams can cry his face off. When I was there, I was like, oh my God. I was like, Grey's Anatomy, they really teach you how to cry on command. Like, that's like, they really nail that in. But his performance was really wonderful, and he's handled this whole entire thing with such grace and such tact that I do feel that he's the one who's going to sort of sneak on in and take the
I hope that if Patti LuPone wins on Sunday, that her speech is just her yelling at the audience, "Don't take photos of the actors." And then, you know,
I hope it's a recreation of her yelling at the woman without the mask.
Right. Yeah.
I mean that
when she screamed bullshit.
When she yelled at the woman at the mask after the talk back, and then she also was like, the woman was like, "We pay your salary as attendees," and she was like, "Chris Harper, the producer of Company, plays my salary." And I was like, this is also just a really good campaign for Chris Harper and Company that everyone's just... If they weren't going to vote for Patti LuPone already, all of the producers are like, wow, she knows our name.
See, who needs onstage slaps? The Tonys have plenty of their own campaigning drama to be appreciated. Well, I want to thank you guys for talking to me about this. Before I let you go, I'm going to go one by one, and maybe in a category we haven't covered or someone's name we haven't mentioned, I'll start with you, Jackson. Do you have a favorite that you're hoping to see win something on Sunday?
I have just two things. One is that if A Strange Loop wins, we should note the fact that Jennifer Hudson is a producer on A Strange Loop. She's among a group of celebrities that sort of at the last minute came in, like John Legend producing, what was it, Jitney, and that's how he has an EGOT. If it wins a Tony, she wins a Tony. She has an EGOT, which is a great redemption story from the time that Jennifer Hudson was not nominated for a Tony when she was in The Color Purple and tweeted that she was being used for her celebrity, not her talent, which doesn't make sense, but is actually kind of what you're doing as a producer. And then in terms of the other performances, I just wanted to shout out the Lincoln Center revival of The Skin of Our Teeth, I thought was really incredible, directed by Liliana Blaine Cruz. And especially Gabby Beans, who did get a nomination in leading actress, but is this young performer who plays Sabina, the maid, a character in Thornton Wilder's play who occasionally breaks the reality and talks to the audience about how much she hates the play and it's confusing, was really wonderful. And when she's in the reality of the play, was doing a sort of like Eartha Kitt as Yzma style Tallulah Bankhead mid-century voice that just makes me laugh so much. And I am sure we will all be talking about Gabby Beans in future productions and who knows what else soon. So I was happy for her.
And what a name. Esther, how about you?
I mean, I honestly mentioned the one that I really want, which is Deirdre O'Connell for Dana H. I'll say that, like, just going through the category, that play should also win sound design because it's the most incredible sound design I've ever seen. And those categories aren't broadcast on the Tonys, or maybe they will be in, like, the pre-show that's airing on Paramount Plus. I honestly have zero idea how that's working. Thanks, CBS. But I that was really sort of the blowing away. Also, shout out, because she's not going to win, but Jennifer Simard, who has been covering Patti LuPone when she was out, is also so funny in her original role in Company, and she won't get it, but props to her.
And Chris, how about you?
Okay, I will say, I saw Jennifer Simard as Patty's part in Company when she understudied, and I actually preferred it with Jennifer Simard in it, and that's going to get people, they're going to come for me in the DMs, and Patty's going to, you know, scream at me, but that's just my take for the production. But okay, for real, though, I want to just highlight two featured performances that I'm really personally rooting for. I know we talked a lot about it, Strange Loop, but I think John Andrew Morrison as Thought 4 in A Strange Loop, he's nominated for Best Featured Performer or Featured Actor in a Musical. He does an amazing, astounding, so deeply felt work that's just really incredible. He sort of plays one of the main character Usher's thoughts in his head, as well as his mom, and we really see this sort of heartbreaking mix of sort of David Morse-esque in terms of love and also hate that comes with having a relationship, you know, a mother who loves God maybe more than she loves her gay son and what that might entail. So really pulling for John Andrew Morrison is phenomenal. And then in the Best Featured Actress in a Play, I was blown away by Kenita R. Miller in For Colored Girls Who Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. She was, they're all different colors in the rainbow, and she was red, and she has this really, speaking of things that I don't know how you do it eight times a week, she has this absolutely gut-punching monologue at the end of the play that has stuck with me. And that show's journey, which it was, you know, it was in danger of closing, and then a viral campaign to sort of keep it open and to buy tickets for, you know, for other people specifically, marginalized people, black people, people of color, to see the play has been really inspiring. And on top of it, she just had a baby like last week, which is, so I don't know how that happened while she's doing the show. So I'm really pulling for Kenita R. Miller, and she's just a stalwart theater actress, and she's fantastic.
Well, those are all great highlights. I have not seen POTUS, but I like The Ring of Rachel Dratch, a Tony nominee. So, I mean, I think that's a victory unto itself. But yeah, it's a great selection. If some of these shows are running and you're planning a trip to New York, please do try to see them.
Also, shout out to Al Morgan Lee, who I believe plays one of the Thoughts in A Strange Loop, and she's nominated for featured actress in a musical, and I believe she is the first ever trans performer nominated for a Tony. And she's incredible on top of
And she has an incredible song where she plays a woman who is, because the main character in A Strange Loop is a usher at the Lion King, and to circle around to us talking about going back to the Lion King, she has a song where her character is just like, I like seeing the Lion King and I like Wicked. Seeing Wicked, and that's enough for me. And it is a really lovely song, so, you know.
So yeah, if you're coming to New York, go see Lion King and Wicked, you know you want to, and then, but go do a third
and
show.
And nothing else. No other interesting theater.
Yeah. Well, Jackson, Esther, and Chris, thank you so much for talking with me today, and have fun watching the Tonys.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. We're continuing our Pride flashbacks. We're moving further into the 90s with In and Out. In the meantime, you can find us at vanityfair.com. You can find us on Twitter at LittleGoldMen and on our own. I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylos.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
And Chris.
Christris.
You can also sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/LittleGoldMen or text 917-809-7096. Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the weirdest description of the movie The Master goes to Richard Lawson.
There's a really, really moving hand job scene.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.